Hello, this is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, now we open this week's Triangle Business Journal to the biz page. And what we find under the heading of Big Box is the article, Alexander Place to Put Planet Fitness in Best Buy Locale. The shops at Alexander Place Retail Center in Raleigh has landed a new anchor tenant, slated for space of a former Best Buy. Alexander Place landlord AP Shops, LLC, has announced that Planet Fitness has signed on for 30,000 square feet of space. Before opening, the building will go through extensive renovations, and the opening date has yet to be determined. We're excited to have Planet Fitness choose the shops at Alexander Space, says Pratik Chandak with AP Shops, LLC. As shops at Alexander Place continues to expand with Phase 2, recently completed, and Phase 3, pre-leasing and breaking ground this year, Planet Fitness's presence as an anchor tenant will play a critical role in attracting the desired tenant mix we are focused on delivering and drive substantial traffic to the center, benefiting all tenants, including Thompson Family Dentistry, who recently joined Phase 2's tenant roster. Alexander Place recently completed its 22,000-square-foot Phase 2 expansion, plans to begin work on Phase 3 this year. Plans for Phase 3 call for 46,000 additional square feet of space in the center. And under the heading of Involved comes the article, Carey Company Gets Broadcast Time, Helps Families in Need. A massive maker of exterior building products that's based in Carey is about to get some airtime. Cornerstone Building Brands is partnering with HGTV's Extreme Makeover Home Edition to showcase home improvement stories and help families in need. Cornerstone has donated products to use in the shows, which began February 23rd. Some of the products being showcased include brick products, stone veneer, windows, and doors. Cornerstone CEO Jim Metcalf has emphasized community initiatives such as Habitat for Humanity. Chief Marketing Officer Susan Sell says Cornerstone seeks to contribute to its communities and give back to deserving families. And under the heading of Named comes the article, Triangle Restaurants Honored as Beard Awards Named Semi-Finalists. Congratulations are in order for some top Triangle restaurants after the James Beard Foundation revealed its semi-finalist for its annual awards, highlighting the top restaurants and chefs across the country. Here's who made the cut this year. For Best Chef in the Southeast, Ricky Moore at Saltbox Seafood Joint. In Durham, Chidi Kumar and Garland, Chidi Kumar with Garland in Raleigh, and Stephen Devereaux Green with Herons in Cary. Outstanding pastry chef, Crystal Swenson with Crawford & Son in Raleigh. Outstanding hospitality, the Angus Barn in Raleigh. Outstanding wine program, Death and Taxes in Raleigh. Under the heading of Big Plans comes the article, Kane Shows Renderings for Clancy and Thay's Property. Kane Realty is finally providing a glimpse of what it plans for the longtime home of Clancy and Thay's Construction Company. New renderings show a mixed-use development for the site on West Cabarrus Street on the edge of Raleigh's Warehouse District. The development's footprint will be about 6 acres, or around 264,800 square feet, and would feature a parking deck and associated utilities. The warehouse district has undergone dramatic changes in recent years, led by Kane's signature project in the area, the Dillon. And under the heading of growing comes the article, Merchants Group Adds Members and Moving to New Spot. The Greater Raleigh Merchants Association's Executive Director, Jennifer Martin, recently told a crowd that the entity, also known as Shop Local Raleigh, is moving to a new space at 4001 Hillsborough Street and has a 10-year lease at what had been an ethnic market. At the association's annual meeting held February 25th at NC State University's Park Alumni Center, she said the association's rent tripled literally overnight at the Johnson Street location. The move comes after a strong 2019 in which GRMA grew to more than 1,000 members for the first time. Looking ahead, Martin spelled out a year in which the organization expects more than 50,000 people for Brugaloo on April 24th and 5th. Other events include the Falling for Local at Dix Park and then the continued partnership with ABC 11 for the Raleigh Christmas Parade. And under the heading of Pitch Day comes the article, ECU Entrepreneurs Fish for Cash and Land Check for $15,000. A pair of Raleigh business leaders were among the judges when East Carolina University held its annual Pirate Entrepreneurship Challenge, and the winners were a husband and wife team who want to make it easier to get fishing licenses. A group of leaders, including Raleigh's Fielding Miller, CEO and co-founder of Cap Trust, and James Maynard, the founder of Golden Corral, were among the judges. The event awarded ECU biology major Mallory Miles and her husband Felipe de Araujo $15,000 to launch FishingLicense.us, a company dedicated to simplifying the process of registering for a fishing license. Felipe is an entrepreneur, and his dream is to have a successful business, she says. My dream is to impact conservation, and I'm excited we have a chance to make both of our dreams come true. Other winners included Snap Slimes, that's second-place winner at $10,000, Honest Blocks, third-place winner at $5,000, and the fourth-place winner Lights Out with a $1,000 prize. The pitch competition of ECU's College of Business and Miller School of Entrepreneurship is currently in its third year. The Miller School was founded thanks to a 2015 donation by Cap Trust's Miller. As entrepreneurs, you're going to face a lot of adversity, he told the contestants. You're not going to get what you want when you want it. It's times like this when you go out there and try your best, and if you don't win, those are the times you learn your lesson and get better and stronger. This year's competition began in October with more than 120 students from 11 schools and colleges competing. So much for the biz page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. Let's now turn to the tech startups and transportation page. And under the heading of acquisition comes the article, Raleigh Tech Firm Pledges More Growth and Jobs. Bolstered by yet another acquisition, Raleigh's Insight Software continues to grow in the city of Oaks and beyond. The company recently announced its buy of Toronto-based financial planning and tax software provider Longview. Terms of the deal were not disclosed. This is acquisition number 11 in what's been about 20 months of operation, Insight Software CEO Mike Lips says. And each deal means bolstering the Raleigh headquarters. In 2019, the company hired more than 158 people in Raleigh. Today, it's just north of 230 employees at its corporate headquarters in 32,000 square feet at Highwoods Properties Forum Complex in North Raleigh. In April, the firm is set to expand into the third floor of its current building, bumping up its capacity to 450 people. We expect to fill that here between 2020 and 2021, Lips says. The The company has 100 job openings globally, with 52 of those in Raleigh, he says. As for Longview, it fills a vital gap for Insight Software, which offers products specifically tailored to make a chief financial officer's job easier. Longview significantly enhances or expands our presence in the corporate tax space and in the budget and planning space, Lips says. And here's a really short little column, but it certainly affects people who fly in and out of RDU, so I suspect you may find this interesting. And it's entitled By the Numbers, and the column is entitled January Marks Another Record Month for RDU. And it shows the in-plane passengers for five major airlines. The numbers are in, and it's another record for Raleigh-Durham International Airport. In the month of January, a total of 492,115 passengers boarded planes at RDU. Here are how the top five carriers fared in terms of in-plane passengers. So Delta leads the pack with 162,479. American, 118,429. Southwest with 85,203. United with 57,206. And fifth is Frontier with 25,174. And under the heading of Ad Tech Platform comes the article, Durham Firm Adds Cash, Plans Growth. Sift Media, a four-year-old Durham startup out of serial entrepreneur Judd Bowman, just closed on $1.5 million in debt. In an interview shortly after the securities filing dropped February 24th, Bowman, whose past startups have included Triangle Exit Stores, Appia, and Motricity, says it comes down to growth. It's really working capital because we had a pretty strong quarter four with the revenue growth, he says. As a private company, Sift doesn't release specifics, but the mobile ad tech platform company was named the ninth fastest-growing company in the Triangle last year. We saw a pretty good acceleration in the business overall, Bowman says. It's not any one thing. One driver is the amount of smartphones across the globe. We're serving about 200 million ads a day now, he says, and the company is doing it with just 16 employees, aided by AI. Bowman predicts that while Sift may not ever have the headcounts Appia and Motricity had, it will see similar successes. With this company, he and his team has taken a different approach, and it's working, Bowman says, pointing to three straight years of EBITDA profitability. While Appia and Motricity had expansive sales and marketing teams, landing the elephants and closing the deals, Sift hired his first sales rep last year. While Appia and Motricity were known for their big venture capital funders, Sift is pushing for capital efficiency, Bowman says. Also on this page, under the heading of Perspective, comes the article, Lenovo Proactive as Impact of Coronavirus Spreads. Lenovo, a global company with a major Triangle presence, has played a direct role in combating the novel coronavirus. Lenovo, which operates what it calls a dual headquarters in Morrisville, is based in China, the center of the outbreak of the deadly disease now known as COVID-19. On a recent earnings call, CEO Yanqing Yang told analysts the company responded immediately to the outbreak and not just in its own factories. We've donated and installed all IT equipment necessary to construct the two new hospitals in Wuhan, Yang said. Yang added that the company has also given away 100 activation keys of our remote office and online meeting solutions to hospitals and small and medium-sized businesses, which are heavily impacted by the epidemic. While the outbreak happened during the Chinese New Year, Lenovo reacted right away and worked day and night throughout the holiday to implement a series of measures to protect the safety and well-being of our employees, Yang said. In its latest quarter, Lenovo reported revenue of $14.1 billion. While server volume grew 18% year over year, The business, based in Research Triangle Park, saw its revenue remain flat at $1.6 billion as a sharp component price reduction resulted in erosion of average sales price, Yang said. Well, now we turn the page and reach the real estate page for this week's Business Journal. And under the heading Grocery Wars comes the article, West Kerry Wegmans to open in August. The Triangle will see the opening of its second Wegmans grocery store in August. Wegmans has scheduled the grand opening for its West Kerry location for 7 a.m. on August the 2nd. The 103,000-square-foot store is located at Davis Drive and Airport Boulevard. It will anchor the new Twin Lakes Shopping Center. I've heard people say Wegmans is the Disneyland of grocery stores, and I couldn't agree more, says store manager Katie Duchnowski. While we set high standards for the products and services we offer, the people are what set us apart. The New York-based company has said it's hiring 450 people for the store, including 180 full-time positions. Construction on Twin Lakes began last year, and Leyland Alliance is the developer. Other announced tenants for the commercial development include PM Pediatrics, Andy's Frozen Custard, Hollywood Feed, Great Clips, and Paris Nails. The West Kerry location was the fourth that Wegmans announced for the Triangle. Plans call for a total of six stores in the region. Duchnowski says her path as a store manager began at 16 years old when she got her first job at a Wegmans location in Erie, Pennsylvania. And under the heading of Eastern Wake comes the article, Apex Developer Plots 93 Homes in Knightdale. A local company is looking to bring dozens of new homes to Knightdale, with plans calling for a mix of single-family homes and townhomes down the road from a local park and a string of popular shopping centers. Apex developer Michael Foley's MF Development LLC has filed plans for The Collection, a 92-home planned unit development that would add residential density to the fast-growing community in eastern Wake County. The project is situated on 28 acres at the intersection of Keith Street and Robertson Street. The project would abut Knightdale Station Park to the north with the Ashley Wilder Dog Park just across property line. Plans for the property call for the creation of a pocket park in the center of the development and include a pre-existing lake and stream. The developer also plans to incorporate public art in the development, subject to approval by the town. And under the heading of Transformation comes the article, Demolition Underway on $120 million RTP Office Campus Redevelopment. The developer behind the massive redevelopment of Park Point in RTP has revealed its plans for the site and demolition is already underway to begin its transformation. Charlotte's Trinity Capital Advisors has unveiled plans to transform the defunct office and industrial space at Park Point into a 650,000-square-foot life sciences and creative office campus. The company plans to invest over $120 million in the project this year, with hopes of completing the project early next year. We're making great progress toward developing the new Park Point. Demo has begun. Walls are coming down. Construction is underway, says Tyson Strutzenberg, Director of Asset Management at Trinity Capital. This campus is what life science and creative office tenants are looking for across the nation. From the look and feel of the design and finishes to the tenant amenities and park connectivity, Park Point will feel different from your typical office or lab space. Plans call for outfitting existing interior space to meet the needs of modern office and life science tenants while redeveloping the building's exterior and the landscaping. Tenant spaces can range from 20,000 to the full 650,000 square feet. No tenants have yet been announced, but Trinity Capital partner Jeff Sheehan says, "We're trying to be much more proactive working with the economic development community to compete nationally for tech tenants. Currently, the property is entitled for over 2 million square feet of additional by-right development. Sheehan says the company has begun discussing what this will look like, but no concrete plans have yet been determined. Additionally, he says, previous owners had considered pursuing a new entitlement to allow for the development of up to 5 million square feet of space, but ultimately decided against it. Now, under the heading of Open in 2021, we find the article, Reservations Begin at Luxury Condo Project in Durham. Work is moving forward on a luxury condo project in downtown Durham as developers look to complete construction next year. New York-based Lambert Development has begun taking reservations for units in the Vega, a condo community on Hunt Street and overlooking Durham Central Park. Plans for the project call for 57 units across 7 stories with commercial space on the ground floor. Units are set to start in the mid-$400,000s. Units will feature 9-foot-plus ceilings and detailed interiors ranging from around 900 to 2,300 square feet. Amenities will include private balconies, a resident club room, and outdoor terrace. Lambert expects construction to begin this year and wrap up by the fall of 2021. The city of Durham has approved site plans for the project and granted a variance allowing the building to occupy more than 20% of the street frontage and be located within 20 feet of a building corner. The developers originally expected to have to remove many of the trees on the site to upgrade overhead lines on Hunt Street, but further study found the tree removal wasn't necessary. MHA Works of Durham serves as the designer on the project, with construction by Resolute Building Company of Chapel Hill. MHA Works is excited to possibly contribute to the residential building environment in downtown Durham while also participating in the enhancement of the community benefit of Durham Central Park, says Jared Martinson, MHA Works Director of the Durham Office, Mixed Use and Multifamily. And last, we find on this page the heading Fayetteville Street, and the article is entitled Hotelier Wants to Bring Luxury Brand to Downtown Raleigh Site. A nationally known hotel entrepreneur is pursuing a high-profile hotel and mixed-use office product at the at the end of Fayetteville Street in downtown Raleigh, with plans to spend more than $110 million on an upscale hotel. The Kessler Enterprise, a hotel development and management firm based in Orlando, Florida, wants to be among the firms pursuing a two-tower project recently proposed by the city of Raleigh. Founder Richard Kessler said his group has been working with Raleigh-based Trademark Properties on the project. The site is currently two parking lots bounded by South Wilmington and South Salisbury Street. Kessler's plans call for a six-story, 220 to 240-room Grand Bohemian Hotel, complete with architectural flourishes and a design to complement the adjacent Duke Energy Center for the Performing Arts. He says the company's projects focus on high-end design and luxury experience. No one can compete with this, Kessler says. Raleigh released a request for interest for the project last month. The request seeks a 500-plus room hotel and a mixed-use Class A office tower to be built on Fayetteville Street. Applicants could apply to pursue both projects or just the hotel. The room count for Kessler's hotel proposal comes in at less than half of what the city wants, but he says the city's open to a wide variety of proposals and that the quality of their project makes up for the difference in size. Kessler officials estimate the cost of a Raleigh hotel will come in somewhere between $110 million and $130 million, putting rooms at about $500,000 per unit. Room rates may hover between $350 and $375 per night, they estimate. Next, we come to this week's cover story, which is entitled A Dual Impact. Raleigh's Gordon Grubb and Charlotte's Clay Grubb have separate companies, but share a common passion for real estate. In 1963, lawyer Robert Grubb started a small real estate investment and development firm called Grubb Properties in the Piedmont town of Lexington. He got his start mainly investing in multifamily units, renovating them or converting them into condos, which was a novel idea at the time. He also extended credit to many of his buyers, who were often the victims of racially discriminatory redlining policies. At the time, nearly all home loans went to white families, his son Clay Grubb says, leaving Robert Grubb nearly all the business in historically marginalized communities. By 1978, Robert Grubb had begun condo conversions in earnest, again often serving as both a seller and the lender, and by the 1980s had expanded to several additional markets in North Carolina, including the Triangle. Ultimately, with the help of his sons Gordon and Clay, and later under their leadership, the company has become a major developer of residential office and mixed-use space across the state, and ultimately, the country. The brothers joined the company in 1987 and 1993. Today, the two sons carry on the family legacy, each leading their own companies, Gordon Grubb in Raleigh and Clay Grubb in Charlotte, and each with their own visions for development and a booming state. At a time when major national developers are entering the state's metropolitan areas, both Grubbs are building signature properties that help define their markets. Gordon Grubb, for example, developed Raleigh's Dock 1053 and is teaming with an Atlanta firm to develop Raleigh Ironworks, which would transform Atlantic Avenue. Clay Grubb, 52, is reimagining the Glen Lennox property in Chapel Hill that dates to the 1950s, as well as a series of projects in Charlotte and elsewhere. They each have different approaches. Gordon Grubb, 59, tends to be more conservative. The joke around the office is that a project has to be within 5 minutes of his house. Clay Grubb tends to be willing to take on more risk and more aggressively pursues the growth of his company. We probably had different levels of risk tolerance, Gordon Grubb says. That's not to say one's right or one's wrong, just different. This dynamic ultimately led to some degree of difficulty when they were each at Grubb Properties. But in the years since Gordon Grubb launched his own venture, Grubb Ventures, the brothers say they've reconciled their differences. He and I communicate every single week, Clay Grubb says. We get along much better as competitors than as partners. Now located in separate parts of the state, they share their respective peers, a passion for placemaking, and a distant past where the family's initial real estate successes came to a shocking end. Henry Clay Grubb, the great-grandfather of Gordon Clay, was a prominent developer before World War I. He was an active builder in the Lexington and Salisbury markets, even developing a 7-story building in Salisbury, then the tallest steel beam structure in the state. The New York Times called Henry Clay Grubb one of the wealthiest men in the state, thanks to his real estate holdings and a whiskey distillery in Florida. But Grubb, the Times noted, had an ungovernable temper. He had even shot and killed his brother-in-law one Sunday afternoon, but Grubb was exonerated because his life had been threatened. On the night of August the 8th, 1913, Grubb was drunk when he entered his large Victorian home in the small town of Churchland, not far from Lexington. He attacked his wife Emma with a knife, but she eventually grabbed a revolver and shot him 3 times. She was acquitted of murder the next day on the grounds of self-defense, according to a story in the Times. Half a century would pass before Robert Grubb, his grandson, got back into the real estate business. In 1963, Robert Grubb started his firm and continued growing his business and adding more properties and products. Among his most notable acquisitions is the historic 70-acre community of Glen Lennox, where he had lived as a college student in Chapel Hill. Soon, the company would see enter a new chapter of growth, with the addition of his sons, Gordon and, later, Clay. Gordon Grubb grew up in Lexington, watching his father run the family business and the boom and bust cycles that came with it. He graduated from Washington and Lee University, and then, at the urging of his father, attended law school at Wake Forest University. After that, his father recommended he pursue further studies in tax law, as he had done. So, Gordon did. Quickly realized it wasn't for him. He left the program, found a job in Washington, D.C., working for then North Carolina Representative Robin Britt. But Britt lost his seat after just one term in 1985, and Gordon decided to return to North Carolina. His father recommended he move to Raleigh and work for the family business, selling condos. If Gordon was to find a place and grow properties, he would start from the bottom up. "It was the best experience I could have ever gotten because I was dealing with a customer," Gordon says. "I was on site on the projects. I could see the property management and what needed to be done." His responsibilities quickly grew, and soon he was helping his father navigate a sharp economic downturn made worse by a quirk in the law. Because Grubb Properties sold condos and held the paper on those properties, the law allowed owners to return their properties for the amount they paid. As property values sank, Grubb was getting his condos back in droves. "It was a very difficult time for him and for the company," he says. "So we then had to take these condos and reimagine them, and in many cases, renovate them. So I came with this idea where we did buyback guarantees. Buyers would just have to hold on to the condos for a few years, giving the company time to pay its debt. And by the time the market recovered, the company was in a good position moving forward." By the early 1990s, the company was back in growth mode, and soon Clay Grubb would join the firm. 7 years Gordon's junior, Clay majored in both economics and management with a concentration in finance at Tulane University. He went to UNC Chapel Hill for law school and joined the family business upon graduating, spearheading the company's expansion into Charlotte and the office market. When he joined Grubb Properties in 1993, the company had just landed its first deal in Charlotte. "Everybody thought Charlotte was the market we needed to be in, so it made sense for me to move to Charlotte and start our office," Clay says. By 1994, Clay had started the company's first fund, Wexford LLC. That fund would later close out in 1999, bringing a 5.6 times return for investors, Clay says. Gordon, meanwhile, remained in Raleigh. As Clay increasingly grew the expansion into office acquisitions and development, Gordon stayed more focused on the core multifamily business. Robert Grubb died in 1995. Suddenly, Gordon was named company president and at the head of a business with markets around the state. He found himself spending more time on the road to Charlotte and less time with his family in Raleigh. At that point, the company had grown to about 120 employees. At the same time, Gordon says his vision for the company was increasingly in conflict with others, and he began questioning whether this role was right for him. "I kind of came to see that maybe it was the best for me to strike on out on my own," he says. "I was just driving to Charlotte all the time, and I had little kids. 9/11 hit, and I said, life is too short." In 2002, he stepped down as president to start his own firm, Grubb Ventures. "It was really hard, because I'd been there 15 years, and I feel like I'd really helped build that company," Gordon says. "It was a tough decision, but as my wife says, the second best decision of my life was to leave and start Grubb Ventures." Gordon went from an executive of a multi-market development firm to a one-man shop with occasional part-time help from a contractor or two. On his way out of Grubb Partners, he had managed to secure some backing and bought back two projects from the family business, the gardens on Glenwood and what would become Glenwood Place, Grub Ventures' signature development in Raleigh. Gordon had previously spent about 15 years talking to the longtime owners and negotiating a deal. As business picked up, Gordon began to build his team. "I was able to recruit some great talent early on," Gordon says, "and my senior team has been with me really since the beginning." Back at Grub Properties, Clay became president and looked to transform the firm from a family-run business focused on North Carolina into a board-run firm with projects across the country. "I created an official board of directors for the company with a mandate that the majority had to have a last name other than Grubb," he says, "and we never had a board member that didn't have the last name Grubb before." The company also began expanding outside North Carolina, acquiring properties across the Southeast. He also began a radical transformation of the company culture, with a renewed emphasis on driving collaboration and consensus through open dialogue and often disagreement. "We really try to get to unanimous agreement on everything we do," Clay says. "That creates a lot more stress in the process. When we make a decision, there's no second guessing, and that allows us to move forward with confidence." "Those early years were tumultuous. I never had really managed people," he says. "My style was different from what most of the folks at the company were used to, so we had a lot of turnover over the first year or two. It's definitely a humbling experience to go through." Ultimately, he says the company's culture has become an asset. Spokeswoman Emily Etheridge says, "When I started here, I was shocked at how much time the senior leadership team spent talking to new hires about the company culture and the goals. I've never had that personal attention." Meanwhile, the first inklings of the Great Recession were appearing, and Clay was quick to notice. In the years leading up to 2008, Grubb Properties ceased all new investments, sold off as many properties as possible, and shrunk the staff from around 200 people to 55. "We went from 38 properties to 5, Clay says. "That was the good news. The bad news is we still had 5. Ultimately, that positioned Grubb Properties to be prepared to recover. Just a few years after the crash, Clay says he had an official from Freddie Mac in his office looking to do business about some apartments in Chattanooga, Tennessee. He said, "You haven't even been to Chattanooga," I said. "I went there for a wedding once," Clay recounts. He said, "I think you have the best performance across the nation, and we'll do it." For the next 4 years, Grubb Properties grew quickly, focusing on those old fundamentals of multifamily deals, similar to what Clay had been doing in the 1990s. In recent years, the company's put a great deal of time and resources into growing its office division. As of the third quarter of last year, the company had built its portfolio to 38 total investments, including over 5,000 multifamily units and over 2.13 million square feet of office space in markets across Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Washington, D.C., and Ohio. Charlotte Center City Partners CEO Michael Smith says, "Grubb Partners is one of the leading voices in finding new ways to use space efficiently and in supporting various modes of transportation, particularly bicycles. I like the cleverness that Clay brings to his projects," he says. Smith says the company often builds projects with office and residential units that can share a parking deck. Additionally, Clay has built a relationship with the Danish firm Copenhagenized Design Company, which incorporates cycling into urban design. It's become a real passion for Clay, where he's taking it beyond his developments and is trying to make sure that Charlotte and other developers and city staff have great opportunities to learn about some of these best practices, Smith says. In the Triangle, the firm is redeveloping the historic Glen Lennox property in Chapel Hill. Construction is underway on the first phase, calling for a new office building, an apartment building on the site with designs that are, naturally, bicycle-friendly. Meanwhile, in Raleigh, Grub Ventures spent the first few years landing deals and building relationships with investors looking for new opportunities in a booming market. True to his original aims, Gordon has kept his company focused on Raleigh and his surrounding municipalities. The company has done projects in Cary, Durham, and Chapel Hill, though the projects they're known for are Raleigh-centric, Glenwood Place, Dock 1053, and now Raleigh Ironworks. While nearly all of these have been success stories, there have been the occasional hiccup. Plans for Glenwood Place, today a bustling mixed-use destination, were originally much bigger, calling for 70 to 140,000 square feet of retail and restaurants, 600 to 800,000 square feet of new office, a full-service hotel, and hundreds of new luxury apartment or condominium units off Glenwood Avenue, just inside the Beltline. The company had to downscale those plans in 2016 due to pushback from neighbors and concerns about traffic impact. Since that time, it's managed to build several large projects, including a collection of mid-rise office buildings and luxury apartments. The company recently announced its latest high-end apartment project on the site. An even bigger challenge has been a collection of properties on Oberlin Road, right next to Daniels Middle School. Gordon bought the land in 2006 with plans to redevelop it, just before the recession, and has yet determined what to do with it. Earlier this year, the company put a section of the property under contract with Liberty Healthcare Management for a new continuing care facility in Raleigh. Still, this has proved to be the exception and not the rule. And these days, Gordon says his company has no shortage of investor interest when pursuing new projects and acquisition. Since those early days, the company has developed 1,148 new residential units and around 407,070 square feet of commercial real estate space, and a whole lot more to come. The company's steady-as-she-goes strategy hasn't led to many flashy, ambitious projects or notoriety outside the Triangle, but they've led to predictably good returns for investors, Gordon says. I'm not sure I'm a 30- or 40-story tower guy, but maybe that's okay, you know, Gordon says. I think I'm more comfortable building 5 or 6 stories. I think I could someday stretch to 10. Earlier this year, the company announced a new high-end apartment complex planned for Glenwood Place, as Gordon considers his options for the remaining 14 acres of the property. Bobby Lewis, a longtime Raleigh developer and Gordon's neighbor, says Gordon has a reputation for a high-quality product that contributes to the growth of the area. He does some really cool things, says Lewis, the co-founder and principal of the Raleigh Development Company. He's just really enhanced our area and made it look so much better just by doing some really good projects. I hope he's got a lot more years left because he's doing a great service. While working together ultimately didn't pan out the way they may have planned, Clay and Gordon have since rebuilt their relationship, talking often and occasionally going on family vacations together. And at family vacations, the real estate talk is kept to a minimum. Our wives don't want to hear it, Gordon says. Occasionally, if I have a question, like on construction costs or something, I'll ping him, and he's always quick to get back to me. Gordon remains an investor in Grub Properties and says since his departure, the two have been able to build a better relationship. I think we kind of realized we could be brothers or we could be business partners, Gordon says. This week's executive voice belongs to Janet Hadar. Janet Hadar first began her career as a nurse, which gave her an intimate understanding of healthcare services and an appreciation of the thousands of workers who keep a hospital running. Over a 30-year career, Hadar has weaved together experiences in the service and business sides of hospital systems, steadily working her way up the organization ladder. And now, thanks to a restructuring of UNC Health, that perspective is more important than ever. As the first female president of UNC Hospitals, Hadar is tasked with running all the medical services the system offers in Chapel Hill. At a time of increasing concern about health care costs and with the industry changing, those responsibilities could seem daunting. Despite a packed schedule, Hadar still picks up every piece of paper and trash off the floor while walking through her hospitals, a habit she keeps despite her new responsibilities. And as you know, the executive voice column is a Q&A, so here are the questions and Hadar's answers. What do you want to accomplish in your new role? I've been with the organization for 17 years, so I know the environment and the broader landscape quite well. My immediate priority, because there have been a handful of organization changes, is to kind of solidify the executive team and fill some much-needed roles. But really, I want to focus on continuing to enhance the culture here, because our workforce is one of our top priorities, and making sure that it continues to enable collaboration, respect, and diversity. You're the highest-ranking woman in the UNC health history. What does that mean? I've been part of the senior executive team for a number of years, and I've always had a seat at the table, so I didn't think much of the importance of my gender. But over the last couple of months, others have pointed it out so much, particularly our workforce, that I've come to recognize that representation really matters, and it's hard to imagine and aspire to things that you don't see. Our nursing workforce is predominantly women, and my background before business school was a nurse. They're really excited about it, and that's really what caused me to pause and recognize that. So, how does that nursing background impact your vision for UNC Hospitals? The clinical background is incredibly helpful to the work that I've done over the years, and I believe that it's made me more effective in driving clinical operations. Perspective always helps, and having been at the bedside or in the clinic with patients, I haven't forgotten those experiences. And I'm very mindful there's so much administrative burden in healthcare today. We don't want to just push that administrative burden onto our direct caregivers. It's not having them check another box. It's thinking creatively about how we accomplish meeting this, the regulation, without adding additional burden onto our providers. My husband happens to be a very busy surgeon at UNC, and so I can't help but notice he gets home late in the evening, and after dinner is often on his laptop signing notes. When I multiply that in my mind, played out against all of our physicians and providers here, it makes me pause before we hold off on providing scribes or other assistants that can help them do their work. What are the challenges ahead? The margin pressure continues to grow for healthcare executives, and the pace of change and disruption in healthcare right now is unprecedented. We're trying to find ways to make sure that healthcare is more accessible and more affordable to patients. And how do we do that without reducing any labor costs that could impact the direct care providers? And so much of our focus now is more about revenue growth and not expense reduction, because that certainly will impact those at the bedside. So how do you manage that? There's great opportunity in the ambulatory environment, particularly as we become more experienced and take on more value-based care. We've got to do a better job of keeping North Carolinians healthy and out of the hospitals. So I think the ambulatory environment is where that's going to happen, and making sure that those ambulatory sites are accessible to all North Carolinians in the rural parts of our state. As the system has grown, it's really opened my eyes to the limitations that many communities in North Carolina face. They lack access to good health care, and we're certainly trying our part to remedy that. And finally, the question, what helps you get through the day? Answer, perspective. We have a saying in our home, when the faucet breaks or a pipe is frozen, it's not a brain tumor, it's not a spinal cord injury. In parenthesis, it says, my husband's a neurosurgeon, so that's why I think these things come up. It's working here and seeing the tragedy that happens to really good people. It brings you perspective, and I think I have tremendous perspective. Now we reach the viewpoint part of the Triangle Business Journal, and the guest column this week is written by John Hood, which is entitled Easy Grades in North Carolina, make for hard landings. Walt Disney was no stranger to adversity. He grew up in a large itinerant family of modest means. His first film studio went bankrupt, but Disney never gave up, and he never stopped learning from his mistakes. All the adversity I've had in my life, all my troubles and obstacles, have strengthened me, Disney once said. You may not realize it when it happens, but a kick in the teeth may be the best thing in the world for you. Celebrating the virtue of perseverance may sound old-fashioned. In reality, however, it's a sound application of modern social science. In education, for example, there's a growing empirical case for the proposition that if we ask more of our children instead of trying to protect their supposedly fragile egos, they're more likely to enjoy success in school and beyond. A new study of grading practices right here in North Carolina has gained significant national attention. Seth Gershenson, an associate professor at American University School of Public Affairs, looked at the records of some 350,000 North Carolina 8th and 9th graders who were enrolled in the state's Algebra 1 course from 2006 to 2016. Gershenson chose these students because they had the same teacher for the whole year and were required to take an end-of-course test to assess their mastery of the subject. For all 8,000 public school teachers covered in the study parameters, Gershenson averaged the grades they gave their students, used a variety of statistical controls to adjust for student background, prior performance, teacher background and credentials, and other variables that might influence the grade averages. He then compared those average grades to the performance of the same students on the end-of-course tests for Algebra 1. The idea, in other words, was to see if the students of tougher grading teachers were more or less likely to succeed than were students of easier grading teachers, all other things being held equal. Gershenson's results suggest that tougher grading practices are an example of tough love. By expecting more at the front end as a student takes Algebra 1, the teacher makes it more likely that the student will eventually achieve mastery in the subject. On average, students assigned to the toughest grading quartile of North Carolina teachers scored 17% of a standard deviation higher on the exam than if those same students had been assigned to the easiest grading quartile of teachers. That's not a small effect. To put this difference in perspective, Gershenson wrote, consider that it amounts to a little more than 6 months of learning. It's also larger than the impact of a dozen student absences or replacing an average teacher with a teacher whose students consistently outperform expectations. Another point of Gershenson's findings, tougher grading standards are not equally distributed across public schools. Suburban schools and those with relatively low shares of poor students tend to have teachers who give lower grades. Rural and high-poverty schools tend to have teachers who give higher grades. It's at least conceivable that teachers and principals in the latter groups of schools worry that rigorous grading might discourage students who are already facing significant challenges to their academic success. Their concern may be well-motivated, but this study shows that acting on that concern is not well-advised. As North Carolina students leave high school for college or the workplace, what matters most is how well they retain and apply what they've learned, not how students feel about themselves. Easy grades early in life can set them up for a hard landing. This week's editor's notebook is entitled, Virus Fears Should Force People to Review Strategy. Whether there's an actual outbreak of the coronavirus during the flu season is almost immaterial at this point, at least for the United States. Right now, perception's everything, and it started creating havoc across financial markets and a vast number of industries that are experiencing a disrupted supply chain. And that means we're going to be affected in the short term, one way or the other. First, the basics. Johns Hopkins University officials note there are more than 81,000 confirmed cases in humans. More than 2,770 have died, and about 30,300 already have recovered. More than 96% of cases were identified in mainland China. South Korea was next, followed by Italy, Japan, and Iran. In the U.S., there were 57 confirmed cases as of February 26th. So far, closest to the triangle, there's been one case each in Chicago and Madison, Wisconsin, Johns Hopkins research shows. So after a tumultuous 2 days on Wall Street, with markets losing more than 8% of its record high value registered February 12th, things started easing off February 26th as some of the buy-on-the-dip investors got back in the market. But all the action in the past few days is a reaction to the fear that coronavirus will become a pandemic and people will contract the virus all over the U.S. and the death toll will be widespread. As for now, nothing suggests that's imminent. The Centers for Disease Control says the outbreak in the U.S. is almost a certainty, but officials refuse to add any color regarding the timing and reach of the outbreak. But focusing on that right now is a colossal waste of time. What businesses need to focus on are the realities. The virus is affecting the supply chain all over the world. If you buy or sell from Asia and now Europe, chances are your goods and services will face disruption in reaching the end user. That would mean delays in purchase orders, delays in payments, and increases in inventory for U.S. manufacturers and resellers. All of it means disruption. Wall Street's not reacting to the actual fears of people getting sick and dying. Wall Street's reacting to businesses not being able to make money. Of course, everything can't always be about money, and regardless of the concentration of a new disease or a virus, the loss of life is a far bigger concern. But we still need to make sure businesses are running smoothly because jobs are tied to our economic well-being. If the health concern goes on for months, then people will start losing their jobs. For businesses, it's time to reevaluate the way they make money. Public companies deeply involved in international trade already are sending out signals that quarterly numbers are going to dip. But what about smaller private companies? Those companies need to ascertain the flow of their revenue, their account receivables, and perhaps most importantly, costs they can digest without disrupting the entire operation. Just last month, while people were watching the coronavirus developments, most people thought it was China-centric and a China problem. Not anymore. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as a person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please call us 919-832-5138. So long till next time.